We're in the Master's Lodge at Trinity College, Cambridge. The Master of Trinity College, Cambridge, in fact, is officially Lord Martin Rees, who is at the end of the couch here, and is also President of the Royal Society. This is the 350th anniversary year of the Royal Society. And I suppose last year was the 800th anniversary year of Cambridge University. So this is an extraordinary fitting setting to be in. Perched in the middle is Patricia Churchland, philosopher from UC San Diego, and at the end, another philosopher and public intellectual, Anthony A.C. Grayling. So we're going to have a conversation which I thought we would start by looking at this handsome, heavy tome here, edited by Will Bryson, seeing further the story of science in the Royal Society, and at least talk about that and its importance in society. Your essay in here is looking 50 years ahead, but you also began by looking at the founders, the instantiation of this notions of Bacon's original ideas, and you talked about the search for enlightenment and the relief of man's estate. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were noble motives in the foundation of all of this. Do you think we're still in the noble territory, or has it all got a bit messy?
Well, it's different because the subject's more professionalised. I mean, the point about the early members of the Royal Society is that they were curious about everything, and their meetings consisted of experiments, travellers' tales, sometimes rather gruesome experiments like blood transfusions between dogs, and even between dogs and a human, and also learning about new instruments, looking through the first microscopes and the first telescopes. But at the same time as these activities motivated by curiosity, they were engaged with the issues of their time, improving navigation, exploring the new world, rebuilding London after the fire. So they were people who were not only sort of curious in the sense, but they were also practical. And my feeling is that science ought to have both those dimensions to it now, although it's harder, of course, for any single person to span the whole range.
Well, you say here, armchair theory alone cannot achieve much. We're no wiser than Aristotle was, in the sense that...
Yes. Well, that's true of
it's technical advances
itself.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think if we look at any science, it's advanced through a symbiosis of technology and science. In my subject of astronomy, obviously, we've advanced because telescopes have got more and more powerful, new techniques of space research and computers, so we've depended on technology, but of course in return scientific advances feed back to improve technology, so there's not this linear model where you have science and then applications. There's an interaction between the science and the applications, but the difference between now and 300 years ago is that individuals clearly have to specialise, and there are very few individuals who can both do the most rarefied theory and the observations and the technology.
Yes, I'm reminded, of course, that when the first meeting that you... Well, the official date that you give to the foundation of the Royal Society, which is 28 November 1660,
right.
Was a group of people meeting at Gresham's College to hear a lecture by Christopher Wren.
Indeed, and the lecture was on astronomy, of course.
Exactly.
Because he was at that time Professor of Astronomy at Oxford University.
From the philosopher's perspective, some sort of large vision of how things have shifted over this period. I mean, from then to yesterday's newspaper with the story of Craig Venter's team having synthesized a cell.
It's very interesting. Martin, of course, is right that the situation is very, very different now with the professionalization of scientific research, in effect, and people being paid, you know, salaries to be scientists all their lives long and the rest of it. And the way that the whole project of scientific research has been institutionalized in the universities and the research centers. So some of the drivers that lay behind the 17th century explosion in science, that there was, for example, increased literacy as a result, really, of the Reformation, when both on both the Protestant and the Catholic sides, the importance of education became paramount and more people came to be able to read. There were mercantile economic drivers, the navigation being a very important one. There was the fact that instruments that had been used in fairs and playgrounds as amusements, you know, the first magnifying and long distance lenses were fairground amusements, and then people recognized that they could utilize these things for their benefit. I mean, all these things came together, and I think probably the most important of them is that 16th century Reformation had at its heart an argument about liberty of conscience and thought. And prior to that time, prior to 1520, it was very difficult for people to go against orthodoxy in thinking about matters of the heavens and the earth and the nature of physical reality. But because the Protestant movement in particular had asserted its right to think for itself, individuals would be their own priests before God and so on, this idea of being free to inquire and to think once again was tremendously important, a great driver. And by the first third of the 17th century, you know, by the trial of Galileo, it had become accepted that, at least in one part of what we used to call Christendom, people could make inquiries and examine and set up laboratories and correspond with one another about maths and astronomy and the rest. And that was a tremendous liberator, I think, to scientific inquiry. Mm.
And the motto of the Royal Society, Nullius et Verba, means essentially accept nothing on authority. So that was the spirit in which they worked. They weren't accepting ancient authorities, Aristotle or anyone else. They were doing experiments and being open-minded.
And do you think that filtered down? I mean, did it filter down to the people who were carpenters and farmers and grave diggers and so forth? I mean, and in particular, the willingness to explore and invent and to be curious about things? Or was it really just a feature of those who were well enough off to be able to be scientists?
Well, of course, there were no professional scientists except maybe one or two doctors and one or two astronomers, but they're all amateurs. But I would imagine if we just think of the number of people who must have been involved in building St. Paul's Cathedral, etc., there must have been quite a large number of people who were involved in building, or indeed building ships for the Navy. Mm-hmm. And so some sort of technical expertise must already have been fairly widespread, one would imagine.
Yes, because, I mean, you know, one fantastic fact about human beings is, right throughout recorded history at any rate, is the sheer ingenuity and skill and all sorts of engineering projects and what have you. I mean, it's a striking fact that between the Dome of Brunelleschi in the 3rd century AD in Rome and the Dome of Il Duomo in Florence in the 15th century, some of those engineering skills have been lost. You know, they couldn't put up a building like that. But I mean, a lot of the sort of skills required for irrigation and building and the rest survived, and they were present. Mm. It wasn't that so much, it was something else. I mean, in 1492, very, very important year this for Christopher Columbus and the expulsion of the Jews from Spain and the reconquest and all that kind of thing. In that year, somebody published a little book called De Auroribus Plinii, on the errors of Pliny. Pliny, the author of the great natural history, which had been regarded as an encyclopedia for centuries and centuries. And to call in question the authority of a great figure from classical antiquity was really quite a novelty. And it was mainly on medicine, on anatomy and so on. So.
I think, though, it must be at least in part a cultural phenomenon that you conceive of yourself as being able to invent and to take what exists and change. Because after all, we think that Homo sapiens have been around about 300,000 years. Mm-hmm. And the first evidence of tools is the discoveries in the Blombos Cave in South Africa, which date at about 75 to 85,000 years ago. So I often wonder, what were they doing of the intervening time? I mean, of course, when you get large groups, that makes a difference. But that's why I think that this presumption that we can invent, we can devise and improve and change, isn't necessarily there, as it were, innately. Otherwise, we would have seen Homo sapiens doing these things much earlier.
But it requires a social context, doesn't it?
I think it does.
Enough leisure time, enough people to toss ideas off, etc.
Yes, and I mean, if you're in a small group of 25 to 30 people, perhaps you don't, although the Inuit did invent quite a lot in the way of rather remarkable tools, even though they were in very small groups. But it is a puzzle to me how it came to be, at least among certain humans, that inventions and creations and discovery about the nature of the world was a cultural norm.
Well, I think that, that leisure is productive of art. Necessity is productive of technology, rather. I mean, if you think about the Second World War, in 1939, the RAF was flying biplanes, you know, Gloucester Gladiators and Swordfish. And by the end of the war, they were flying the Whittle jet. And the Germans had the Messerschmitt 262. So conflict and stress and times of anxiety and necessity are tremendously quick drives of technology. Whereas, on the other hand, the leisure, the sufficiency of food, the pleasantness of the weather, which would allow you to paint in a cave or make little figurines of women or something, that really requires leisure.
But I don't think I don't think it's necessarily the case, though, that the activities of the founders of the Royal sort of gave everybody else license to be inventive. I don't think that's what you mean.
No, I don't think so.
If you read around the period, as you know from Steve Chapin's work, there was an awful lot of artisans and mechanics who were already doing very inventive things. And of course, the coffee house, the sort of coffee internet of the 1660s was amazingly fertile place for people to pass on ideas.
Well, crucially, not just the coffee house, but the whole network of correspondence among savants in 17th century Europe. And there were people like Mersenne and Gassendi and others who were great correspondents and kept everybody in touch with everybody else. And in particular, in the early part of the century, mathematical discoveries and Cartesian physics and the rest were very widely disseminated by that means. They were the internet of the day. And without that, and one aspect of that, by the way, that it was also a spying network, as we know. I don't know whether Martin's looked into how many of the founders of the Royal Society were spies, but they were passing intelligence and a little bit of maths on the side.
Yes. And then the Scientific Journal, of course, started in the 1660s, really. But I think going back to necessity, stimulating technology, I mean, that's clearly been true, and it's normally been military technology.
It normally has been.
And
military.
I think one benign thing is that probably this is the first era in human history where it's not been the case, because for instance it used to be that military technology stimulated electronics, whereas now it's computer games which are the real frontier. They're ahead of the military, and this is a really benign development.
Yes, that's a very good point.
So you mentioned when we were at the Royal Society, I actually did made a mention of this, that in 1665 Henry Oldenburg became the first editor of the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, which is the first peer-reviewed journal, right? And has been
continuous
existence since then. Tell me about the communication of science and the state of communication of science today in terms of journals and so on, peer review. Because I've heard some scientists say that the thing has got too big and it's broken and it's very difficult.
Yes. Well, I mean, obviously the traditional scientific journal goes back 200 or 300 years, and it's still in existence, has a sort of quality control. But two things have really changed. One is that science is much more global. I mean, as you said, there was international science even in the 17th century, but just within Europe, in effect. Asia was left out. But just to quote, to contrast the anecdote which I give in my chapter in this book, 10 years ago, three Indian mathematicians, a professor and his two students, came up with some new algorithm for code cracking in number theory. They put this on the web. Within a day, 20,000 had downloaded it, and there were ad hoc meetings about it all around the world. Contrast that with 100 years ago, when G.H. Hardy, a professor of mathematics in this college, received scribbled letters from a student in Mumbai, Ramanujan, who had never seen any journals. And fortunately, Hardy realized this guy wasn't the average green ink scribbler, but had real insight and supported him. But not just 100 years ago, but indeed until 20 years ago, if you were off the main circuit, or if you were in a place in India where mails were slow, you were really handicapped in science. And so what has happened now is that journals still exist, but those journals are now available electronically, so there's a level playing field. But of course the other thing that's happened is that the formal scientific journals are now supplemented and often bypassed by informal communication. I mean, blogs and all the rest of it, which on the whole enriches science. And I think the openness is very important. I mean, to give another example, where peer review was grossly violated, there was the episode of cold fusion about 20 years ago, where you remember that Pons and Fleischmann claimed they'd done a tabletop nuclear fusion. Within a year, enough people had tried and failed to reproduce this that a consensus developed that there was nothing in it. And so no great harm was done except to the reputation of Pons and Fleischmann by this episode. But supposing that Pons and Fleischmann had worked in the Livermore lab or somewhere like that, some secret laboratory, then you could well have imagined that their laboratory director would have realized this was some stupendous discovery, and a huge crash program could have developed in secret. Indeed, the X-ray laser was such an example in Livermore. And so the message I draw from that episode is that peer review is the ideal, but it's hard to maintain that universally. But if we can't maintain it, let's at least keep openness, because if people publish openly, they can be criticized openly, and the blogs and internet, etc., then consensus will emerge, perhaps even more quickly than it would by traditional routes. But openness is crucial.
See, I think Martin really puts his finger on the nub of the benefit and the disbenefit of the internet. The benefit is the openness and the immediacy, and the fact that if somebody does make a claim, you know, loads of people are going to jump on it and start testing it, and that's absolutely wonderful. The downside of it is that the internet can serve as what people themselves fondly think of as a kind of salon de refusé. You know, they publish their stupid papers on the internet, which wouldn't have got into a peer-reviewed journal for the very good reason, for very good reasons. And then, unfortunately, some these things replicate, or misinformation gets out on the internet. I mean, the internet, apart from being the biggest laboratory wall in the world, is just covered with all sorts of, you know, graffiti from self-publicizing individuals. It's also a tremendous replicator of error. Yes. And misinformation, and you've got to know how to deal with it properly. The necessity for expert filters being placed on information and serious science and the rest, yes, remains. In fact, it's more necessary now than it ever has.
This is a real problem, and this is an issue, of course, in the climate change debate, where if you look on the internet, you find a whole range of opinions on anything, and the lay person who gets information that way is naturally very confused. But the analogy I give there is that if you've got some disease, you look on the internet and you find a whole range of suggested potions and remedies, but in the case of a disease, you've got enough sense to attach more weight to the opinions of people who seem to have some sort of credentials in the subject, and not to attach equal weight to everything. And somehow there's got to be a way in which people are led to attach greater weight to the more credentialed people in any topic, and not take everything of equal weight. But we want to do that without being accused of censorship or without suppressing the genuinely original outsiders.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Without violating the motto of the Royal Society.
Right. Nolio sin verba. I've asked you all independently, and people can go and look at this on the Science Network, what you think the rightful place of science is, referring to the Obama thing. But assuming that, as you all agreed, that it was basically a good thing, and anyway, we have it, there's nothing you can do about it, what do you think are the most exciting developments that are going on in science at the moment?
Well, Pat must be an advocate for neuroscience.
Well, I mean, certainly within the neurosciences, there is an awful lot that's going on that is very exciting. But of course, one of the things that's likely to prove really fertile is the work that Craig Venter is doing in developing ways to make cells that have very particular kinds of genes that will make very particular kinds of molecules, because this will allow for certain sorts of interventions in diseases that hitherto have really proved difficult to deal with. So I think that's one thing. Certainly stem cell research is going to get increasingly interesting. From the point of view of neuroscience, it may be interesting in addressing some diseases that have also been very difficult, such as Parkinson's and Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS, and perhaps others as well. Alzheimer's, I think, is going to be much more difficult. I think autism is going to be much more difficult, but we'll see. But there are major issues that remain really unresolved in neuroscience, having to do with how the bits and pieces are organized in such a way as to get a coherent story of the world, to have, so that a brain has a coherent model of the person, that it has a coherent model of its past and its future. And that kind of coherencing that occurs in nervous systems and is a really essential part of what makes them successful is just not understood at all.
Yeah, just before you move, there's another additional point in there, which was that some of the things that you mentioned there are clearly what would be called translational.
Let's
fix
yeah.
a disease.
Yeah.
And there is a trend going on at the moment, I just interject this, where a lot of the, because of the constraints with financing, a lot of the work is now being directed from government agencies particularly to produce translational stories, in other words, basic fundamental research is not necessarily looked on quite so kind as it used to be. Do you disagree, Martin, or what?
Well, I think as the cost goes up, clearly the public is wanting to see some sort of payoff. But of course, there are risks in expecting a quick payoff, because even in targeted research, like in drugs, then it may take up to 20 years from the original research to a clinically approved drug. And obviously, many of the most important advances stem from entirely curiosity-motivated research. So what one can't really predict the outcomes. And if we look at the provenance of any important application, then it can be traced back to a whole lot of quite surprising discoveries made serendipitously in many cases.
Yes.
So I think it's very important to realise that although the reason we do science is because it is part of an enterprise that in the long run pays off. Mm. We can't expect every particular thing to pay off. I mean, it's like in a game of football, it may be just two or three players who score the goals, but that doesn't mean the other players were not doing anything and they needn't have been there. And so one has to think of science as being something which has to be supported and has to have a certain spirit and ethos in order to lead to these occasional payoffs.
You know, I once asked Francis Crick if he and Watson had any idea, even in the couple of years after the discovery, mm-hmm. of where it was going to lead. I mean, might it actually lead to being able to identify who was the rapist? Mm-hmm. Would it have those sorts of implications? And he said, you know, in all honesty, I have to say we had no idea. Mm. He said, we knew it was an important discovery in the theoretical domain because it was going to answer a very important question, or at least it was the leading edge of an answer to the question of how information is transferred from parents to offspring. But he said, we had no idea that it was going to end up being practical in this really huge, diverse way.
Give an example, the laser. The laser was based on an idea of Einstein 40 years earlier. Mm. And it was produced in 1960, and the inventors had no idea it would be used for eye surgery or for DVD players, etc. Mm. So that's an example where it could be traced back 40 years and forward 40 years.
Yeah. I mean, I think among the reading public, you know, people who read magazines like New Scientist and the newspapers which report discoveries in science, this thought that science produces unexpected things and you know, blue sky research can sometimes really pay for itself and sometimes not, and so on. That point is well understood, but it's not that well enough understood in general terms. I mean, the point that Martin made earlier was if big money goes into research, the public eventually wants to see some kind of return from it. And this is a function of the widening C.P. Snow gap in a way. It's widened even more in the last 50 years than it was in 1959 when he identified it. A lack of scientific literacy on the part of the general public. And there's a huge job of work to be done to explain to them just what scientific research is about and how sometimes it can fail to reach the answer that it wants to reach, but in the process it might have all sorts of other spin-offs might have come out of it. Take, for example, what's happening at CERN in Switzerland. Mm. The Large Hadron Collider work there. It's only just in the last year or so begun really to boot up and get the energy levels, and you know some work is starting to come out of it now, and it's a hugely exciting thing, because if they really do find what they're looking for, or if they don't, either way, it's going to be a massive result in elementary particle physics. But in the process of doing this, very expensive and very long-term things, taken over 20 years to do so far, it's already justified itself. Right from the you know, from the World Wide Web, which came out of CERN, to developments of lenses and bits of technology and sort of by blows of the whole process. It's already justified itself by doing what fundamental scientific research so often does, and that is to turn up all sorts of things that are absolute gems.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and of course another point is that the public clearly can't understand the details, but they can understand general ideas of science, and I think we should be able to explain the ideas of science to everyone. But people don't generally realise how little we understand. I mean, to take one classic example, Nixon's war against cancer. I mean, you know, it was well-intentioned, but at that time, people didn't quite know what to do. They had to just learn more about cells and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. And in the long run, quite a lot did come out of that. But that's an example where you can't tackle a grand problem head on. You have to approach it in a piecemeal way. And the public, therefore, needs to realise that when scientists seem to be working in some rather oblique way on what looks a rather minor, specialised thing, it's not because they don't care about the big problems, it's because they know the big problems can't be tackled head on, but only via building up a general understanding of the entire field in a piecemeal way.
So this notion of increasing scientific literacy without being condescending about it and so on, I mean, how do you do it? I mean, you've had lots of events this year, there's an increase in the number of science festivals, now, I suppose it's next week, the World Science Festival's in New York, there's a Cheltenham Science Festival coming up. Science festivals are one thing, but how do you get across some of the more important fundamental issues of how science is done? And there isn't a scientific method, but the various methods of science.
Well, I think obviously more of the same, and I genuinely think that it is possible to convey the essence of any discovery without too much distortion, even in the absence of mathematics and in the absence of jargon. And incidentally, one has to avoid not just mathematics, but unfamiliar vocabulary, and even more familiar words used in unfamiliar contexts. Like, for instance, degenerate has a special meaning in science, which is quite different from its regular meaning. And so you've got to make sure you use words in a meaning which everyone understands. So I think one should do that. But actually, I tend to feel that scientists sometimes protest too much about public ignorance for two reasons. First, I think it's gratifying how much public interest there is in subjects like my own, which are far away from any practical concerns. People are fascinated by the big problems of the universe, life in space, dinosaurs, the Big Bang and the brain. There's very wide public interest of a purely intellectual kind. So I don't think one should be too disappointed. And it is true indeed that if there isn't some feel for science on behalf of the public, then the public can't engage properly, as they should as citizens, in addressing all the issues of public policy where science is important, like environment, climate, energy, health, stem cells and all that. So it's true that the public needs to have some basic understanding to participate as citizens. But that's equally true in other areas of public policy, like what we should be doing in Afghanistan or the Middle East. Mm. And there again, one should equally deplore the fact that many people couldn't pin Afghanistan or Syria on the map in the right place. And so I don't think the ignorance of science is any worse than the ignorance in other areas. And in all cases, basic ignorance is an impediment to proper involvement of citizens in important issues.
Well, this is, it's a very interesting and I think a good point. What it makes me think of is going to a major art exhibition in a London or a New York gallery. You can't get in because there's too many people and you can't see the pictures because there's too many people. You're all barging one another along. So you think, my God, you know, the whole population is here and they're all interested in art. It turns out that there's a very active and vigorous constituency with that interest, and this is true also, I think, of people who go to science fairs and who buy popular science books and the rest, and become very knowledgeable. But they are, I think, a minority nevertheless. Yes. And our problem is much more the majority, the people who voted elections and who are prepared to see cuts to science budgets and so on. It's them, I think, that we need to get at a bit more. And among the things, because a huge number of very sterling efforts are made to communicate science to people, these things you were speaking of science fairs and so on, programs on television, Discovery Network, National Geographic, all these, I think are wonderful. But it really has to start a lot sooner. And the key thing is how you teach kids at school about science. And there must be a question mark about how it's done, given how few people come out of school with the sort of basic skills to go into science study. Surely there might be a way of doing it. I'm sure teachers for whom I have tremendous respect, they do try tremendously hard, but they've got to find some way of getting kids into that mindset. It can't be true that it's sort of innately the case that only a very small proportion of people can understand maths or understand science.
Well, there's also this end of the spectrum. This is from your essay in this book, Martin, the role of academies and citizen scientists. And I noticed that when we were at the Royal last week, there was a little brochure you have about, it's a scheme that you have for involving politicians in pairing them with scientists.
Well, right, yes. Well, that's a very small amount, but it's the idea is that a young scientist spends a week with them.
Oxford, where one of the few people who was sympathetic to science had just lost his seat by
167
votes. So do you think it's a good idea that more people be encouraged to become politicians who have a scientific
background? Well, two things. I mean, I think certainly one would like to have a few more people who've got professional experience in science, in politics. Indeed, one would like people with a wider range of professional experience generally, because one of the problems in politics is that most of the people now, including our present leaders, are people who've done essentially nothing apart from politics and PR advising other politicians. And I think there's a weakness there. And we'd like to see a few scientists in a broader mix. But I think another thing, though, is that if I look back at the previous parliaments, there were a few members of parliament who took science quite seriously, but they weren't necessarily people who had a professional background. In fact, the chairman of the most relevant committee, the Select Committee on Science and Technology, was a school teacher with no scientific background, but he did a jolly good job. There were a few, like Evan Harris, who did have professional expertise, but we can't depend just on them. And just as the best science journalists aren't necessarily people with a background professionally in science, so the most effective politicians in understanding the importance of science may not be those who are themselves professional, but certainly we want more. And the kind of thing we're doing in the Royal Society is obviously to engage with them all and say we're willing to brief them. And I've just written letters to all the new MPs who seem to have some sort of scientific background saying we will do this. And also we do have this sort of pairing scheme whereby a young scientist spends a week with a member of parliament, you know, and hopes that they will learn a bit about politics, and the MP will go to their lab.
And we hope that the scientists won't be thoroughly corrupted by the experience.
Right.
I sometimes worry in the States that there is a problem about extremists, probably on both the left and the right, who tend to be both anti-intellectual in general, but also, for whatever reason, to be really rather deeply anti-scientific and to think that science is sort of pushing its own political agenda. This, of course, has happened notoriously in the case of climate change. But it happens in a number of areas where you would like to see really good reporting and on the science of some particular kind of issue, whether it's climate change or the recent oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico or whatever. But there are some very popular television channels where an ideological message is the message with respect to science. And I find that really quite worrisome because I don't know how to reach that audience, since what they tune into is that particular station and they watch their news there or they listen to Rush Limbaugh. And so I don't know how you reach that audience because they are not the people who come to science fairs and who read science journals, but they do vote, and they, at the moment, they're very vocal in the United States.
Well, the other sort of 800-pound elephant in the room, I mean, we just came from Oxford, right? There was a meeting on science and religious conflict. I mentioned in my remarks at the end of the meeting that in 1658, 2 years before the foundation of the Royal Society, the warden of New College was John Wilkins, who had for a number of years before that had a group, one of the invisible college groups being set up. He later became, as you well know, Master of Trinity, actually.
Only briefly, for 1 year.
Very briefly, because he married Cromwell's sister, right. And then he became Bishop of Chester. Yeah. But there was this... there are some people who argue that there was science and religion were not at odds in the foundation of the Royal Society and the movement of science. Now as I come in, some magazines picked off the newsstand, The Man Delusion. We've lost touch with God and reason. Here's philosophy now. Is God really dead? These are current issues. Beyond the new atheism, one I filched from your desk outside, Physics World, the April issue, an Islamic Renaissance, science in the Muslim world. So the science-religion issue, I mean, which one thought was going away, seems to be still rather large.
Well, I think it is, and there's fundamentalism and creationism, especially in the US. And of course, religion comes into other debates. I mean, you know, the GM crops debate, for instance. There are a whole lot of people with different views. You know, in the UK, we had this rather strident debate: Frankenstein foods being terrible, etc. That was so much religion. It was sort of echo freaks, as I would call them, people who believe that ecology has to be natural, etc. But of course, at the other extreme, there were in the US people in positions of power. Wasn't it Reagan's Environment Secretary Watts, who was one of the people who thought the world would only live 50 years, we may as well use up all the redwood trees before then and all that. Right. So there are people who have a negative effect on the debate because of some religious perspectives. Mm-hmm.
Mm. But if you ask why there is this noisy debate going on at the moment, trying to understand it, you have to take a few steps back and have a look at the slightly longer picture. Before 9/11, which I think is a watershed in lots of different ways, it is certainly a watershed in the religion, non-religion debate, because a lot of people who didn't have a religious commitment beforehand, but who were prepared to, you know, sort of not say anything, people who came to a dinner party wouldn't in the old days, at least in this country, avow a religious commitment, even if they had one, since it would have been regarded as bad taste to do it in the wrong setting. And people who didn't have religious commitment would, you know, it was the respect agenda, quote unquote, that you didn't, you know, make an unpleasant nuisance of yourself with respect to somebody who had a religion. I always trot out the joke, because it's very apropos in this connection, that the attitude that people had to people of religion, or Christians, was that they were like people who had a recent death in the family, which is sort of very apropos. There was a kind of tenderness towards them that you had to, you know, respect them. After 9/11, that changed, and people who were not very pleased about religion thought, oh Lord, you know, we're back to this problem of a really serious dilemma that we're facing, and we're not going to keep quiet about it anymore. We're going to stand up and say, look, this is a silly outlook and we oppose it and blah, blah. And this is where the noisy things come from. But what it meant was that there were two viper's nests sort of waiting to be provoked. And one of them had already been pretty noisy for a long time. That was the fundamentalist wing of the American population down in the South. And the other was Islam, the Islamic world, or the Muslim majority world. And I think both, you know, ever since the Scopes trial in the 20s, the religious right in America had been reorganizing itself in various ways. They were given a great stimulus by the civil rights movement in the 60s and early 70s and abortion and everything else to become active and vocal, to organize, to get radio stations, television stations, to start up these mega churches, to try to mobilize people who, you know, were of that opinion. And they've been a very powerful force in American society. And so they were latent for a long time. After all, America was founded by religious dissidents who were very keen on their right to be religious. So there was a problem waiting. And the Muslim majority world, I think, for very understandable reasons, feels threatened and under pressure from the globalizing West. You know, again, I use the example of a traditionalist, devout Muslim father with teenage daughters seeing an American movie with girls running around in bikinis. And this must be very alarming and upsetting and very threatening. The result is not that the, you know, mass of people in the Muslim world itself rise up as one man and attack the West, but the more educated, Western-aware, younger male fringe of that world gets angry and has taken action, as we've seen. But all this doesn't amount, to me, to a resurgence of religion In fact, it speaks, it's a symptomatic to me of religion feeling very under threat and on the back foot. Because, of course, the world has been secularizing pretty dramatically since the 17th century. And everything that has gone with it, like pluralism, individual rights and autonomies, democracy, the expansion of science, all these things, have been, you know, as an overall trend, extremely powerful, very dominant in the world. And the traditionalists are worried by it, and that's why they're fighting back. And there's an historical precedent for it, on which I end, which is that when the Roman Catholic Church lost power in the 16th, 17th centuries, it fought back in the bloodiest and most destructive way imaginable because it was losing a grip. And I think I see the present circumstances being very similar to that.
That's very useful mm-hmm. perspective. That's very, mm-hmm. very useful.
So what are your sense about the optimistic direction science is going at this point? What are you most optimistic about in terms of the seeing further?
Patricia's mentioned the developments in synthetic biology, which clearly are somewhat scary in a way.
Aren't you alarmed by that?
I'm somewhat alarmed by the bioterror issue and the fact that. People with the mindset of those who make computer viruses may make real viruses. And I think this is a real threat. And that's been something which has been prominent in the commentary on the recent discovery. But nonetheless, I think we should see this as just a step. Dangers were already there. And it's just slightly easier to make these pathogens now than it was. So it's a gradual process. So I'm very excited about that. But if you ask about other areas of science where I'm excited, I mean, obviously my own science far away from the Earth, it's wonderful that we now know that most of the stars up there have planets around them and we learn more about those. And so the night sky is going to get much more fascinating and we learn about other planets. Maybe some like the Earth. But quite apart from that, I think another generic area of progress, as important as what Patricia mentioned, is the growing power of computers. They are already ubiquitous in science for data analysis and monitoring, etc. But with greater miniaturization, etc., they're going to be far more pervasive. And also it'll be possible to get and analyze huge bodies of data and also to do increasingly realistic simulations. I mean, in a subject like mine, I can't crash galaxies together for real, but I can crash galaxies together in a virtual world in a computer. And calculations of that kind are going to play a bigger role in all subjects. I mean, obviously, weather prediction is one, but maybe some real chemical experiments can be replaced by computer simulation. So I think as computer power continues to increase, then I think computer simulations will be more important. And also the way in which computers and robots interact with us mm-hmm. is going to become more pervasive. I mean, as we know, robots are still rather primitive in the extent to which they can actually use their senses and interact with people, but that'll come. And already, of course, they have intellectual advantages over us in many ways. So I think computers are going to be ever more important in allowing us to simulate real-world phenomena. Also, they're going to be very important, especially miniaturized ones for monitoring mm-hmm. health and everything. Mm-hmm. And so that's a generic technology which is going to be very important. And in a sense, there's almost a convergence between what I've been saying and what you've been saying, in that the way in which computers will improve is by nanotechnology, where you get down almost to the scale of individual atoms in constructing computer memories, etc. The bottom-up building of little machines. Nanotechnology is essentially doing what nature does. So there's, in a sense, a convergence between what's happening in these two major areas.
Yeah. I mean, I think robotics is what one major spin-off of the almost exponential increase in computing power that we're witnessing at the moment across the whole range. I mean, you know, Japan already, they have robots that look after babies and elderly people, or help them to some extent anyway. I mean, they are still pretty crude, although they look like real human beings sometimes. Mm-hmm. There will be a sort of massive boon from all that in lots of different ways. But they also create, as all these things do, a need to be watchful and thoughtful. For example, military robots, deep penetration robots. We're already seeing a move from using real soldiers and airmen to using drone aircraft for attacks and surveillance. And we'll get these automated troops eventually, I suppose. They've even got some prototype deep penetration military robots now, which fuel themselves on biomass. And this has, of course, caused us great alarm that they'll be eating enemy soldiers to fuel themselves. And then the problem is, will they be able to distinguish between enemy soldiers and civilians? And given that most of the conflicts in the world today are conflicts against insurgencies, where you can't distinguish really between the combatants and the civilians, what will these machines do, and how do we govern them? So, you know, those are difficulties that arise, but then it's the rent we pay to the universe for every advance we make in any respect is that we've got something to worry about, and we have to think of an imaginative and responsible way to control it.
Yeah, but your territory here, I mean, the all of these things are wonderful, but the meeting we just did last week was Linda Partridge's meeting on the science of aging. Lifespans, healthy spans, health spans are increasing, people living much longer. And we talked about whether, in fact, they are now pondering the meaning of life more. I see so many books coming out in just the last 2 or 3 weeks about these huge meaning of life issues. What constitutes the self? Is the neuroscience getting any closer to those sorts of issues? Do you not think that these sort of more philosophical things are going to come to the fore as well? Forget the robots.
Well, I mean, as we were talking about this earlier, I think especially with regard to understanding mental states and the self and decision making in neurobiological terms can kind of unnerve people. And because there is a sort of very natural disconnect between thinking of yourself in the good old-fashioned way and then thinking of yourself in neurobiological terms. And I think it is kind of hard to see how that, you know, comes together. On the other hand, it is a fact that many, many people who are otherwise not terribly interested in science are interested in the science of the brain. I mean, they want to know why old Uncle George was an alcoholic, and they want to know what happens to their mom when she suffers dementia and doesn't recognize them anymore. And they want to know what the difference is between this lovely child who's 10 years old and this rather beastly teenager who's 13. And so it may be that, as in other places in science, this disconnect, you know, can bother us a little bit, but not so we really get the existential willies and say, okay, no more science. But I think, if I can answer, you know, your question in a slightly different way, I think there are two really, really major social issues, especially in America, that have risen to the fore. And one certainly has to do with drugs. And this is in part a scientific issue, and it's in part a social issue. And the drug laws, as they currently stand, put massive numbers of people in jail for significant periods of time for possession of substances that are really not good for you, but they're not worse for you than alcohol. And there has to be a time when the science of drugs such as marijuana and cocaine are come into focus, or at least are coherent with what the politicians say. I mean, the politicians, many of them know better, but they still maunder on about the drug war and so forth, partly, of course, because they are trying to placate extremes on both sides. And somehow, it would be quite wonderful if we were able to find a way of getting the science of drugs and addiction out there in a straightforward, uncomplicated way that doesn't muddle things through technical language, and then explain to people how this does not line up well with the human and monetary costs of the drug laws. Yeah, I mean, I think actually England is probably much better off in this regard than we are.
No, not a lot really better off now. No, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. And I think you really put your finger on one aspect in which science really ought to be much more robust in trying to, mm-hmm. you know, square up the political process a little bit. Oh. I mean, here in the United Kingdom, no politician would dream of liberalising drug legislation because the tabloid newspapers would crucify them.
That's right. Mm-hmm. But they know better.
Yeah, but they do know better. Yeah. And it's the kind of case where if you had, you know, political courage could make a significant difference in this respect. And I absolutely agree with you. But Roger asked us about the meaning of life, and I think in a very important, significant way, science in the last four centuries has provided us with the right kind of setting, not just in its way of changing our view of the universe, but via its applications through technology to transforming life, especially in the Western world, to giving us the setting in which we can answer that question. And I'll come back to it in just one little second. Mm-hmm. But I want to emphasize the point about the revolution in the human view of the universe effected by science, especially in our Western cultural tradition. 800 years ago, when this University of Cambridge was founded, most people would have looked up at the starry sky and assumed that all the bodies there were revolving around Earth and that we were the pinnacle of creation and we were the center of everything. And science has long since taught us that that's not the case, that the universe is a much more fascinating place than that. That's rather a boring story, the original one. And we are here on a little planet in a solar system on a main sequence star, which is just one of many billions in our galaxy, etc. So we've got a very different perspective on the universe. And that's been important, I think, because it's enabled us to see ourselves differently, not just the universe. And by liberating us in all sorts of ways, for example, from toil on the soil, from ignorance, from illiteracy and the rest, it's enabled us all in the Western world today in the year 2010 to live the kind of life, have the choices and possibilities that 400 years ago only wealthy aristocrats had. Mm-hmm. And even they didn't have what we ordinary folk have got today, namely a range of opportunities to find out about things in a much more accurate and realistic way. And this applies to the meaning of life question as follows. It has enabled us to see that there is many meanings, meaningful lives, as there are people to live them and choose them. With plurality and diversity and education literacy, there are lots of opportunities for people to live in ways that are richly satisfying for them, which they can find out about things, in which they can make choices, they can construct good relationships with other people, because good relationships are at the very heart of good lives. And these are things that were forbidden to people in the past. And indeed, to many of our fellow human beings in the world today, these things are still forbidden because of tradition and religion and the rest. And this is a very valuable bit of progress, at least in our hemisphere. And it means that if you went to somebody and you said, what is the meaning of life? The expectation would be that person would reply, well, the meaning that I find or make in life is, and they can give you a very legitimate and plausible answer to your question. It's no longer a one-size-fits-all, top-down answer to what the meaning of life is. There are lots of meaningful lives, and that's been made possible by the liberation of the human spirit in the last four centuries, very largely owing to science.
That seems a nice note, especially in this, as I said, in this 350th anniversary of the foundation of the Royal Society. So let's continue the conversation a little later on, but thank you in the interim, Martin Rees, Patricia Churchland, A.C. Grayling. Thanks very much.